Curiosity with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, and welcome to Robots episode number 121, the first episode of 2013. I am Jana, and myself and the entire team behind the Robots podcast would like to wish you a successful new year 2013. To start the year off, we'll hear from Rob Saunders about curious and creative robotic systems. But first, here are the news with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. Japanese car maker Toyota has announced an autonomous car fitted with radar and camera equipment that can detect other vehicles, road lane lines, and traffic signals. The technology is intended to assist drivers. However, according to Toyota, it allows the car to navigate streets without a driver. With this latest announcement, Toyota joins other major car manufacturers, including Volkswagen, Audi, and Volvo, in the development and public demonstration of autonomous vehicles. In other news, a new LEGO Mindstorm suite is bringing LEGO robotics capabilities to the next level. The LEGO Mindstorm's EV3 is centered around a single programmable brick. Each brick comes with an ARM9 processor and embedded 16 MB flash memory running Linux, has 4 input and output ports, a matrix display, and a loudspeaker. USB 2.2, Bluetooth 2.1, and Wi-Fi connectivity, as well as an SD expansion slot, round off the package. Each of the smart bricks is meant to control a different motor, sensor, or screen. While EV3 bricks can be programmed via Mindstorm's development interface on a computer, simple programming is now also possible directly via the brick's interface. In addition, EV3 is compatible with iOS and Android, and LEGO is releasing mobile apps for programming and controlling your robot creations. Kits of the new LEGO Mindstorm EV3 will retail at $350 in the US starting this summer. Finally, researchers funded by the Wellcome Trust have created a projectile vomiting robot. A video shows the robot forcefully expelling large amounts of liquid into its surroundings. The researchers used the robot to get an insight into the spread of noroviruses, which, in the US alone, cause 21 million illnesses per year, second only to the common cold. Noroviruses are highly contagious. By inducing projectile vomiting, the virus is aerosolized, allowing it to travel far through the air. Just how much so is subject to the robot study. For more information, including videos of vomiting robots, have a look at robohub.org.
Dr. Rob Saunders is a researcher in computational creativity at the University of Sydney in Australia. With a background in artificial intelligence and design studies, he develops creative systems. His early software developments gave people the tools to explore creative possibilities. Today, he works on modeling creative processes and developing computational models of self-motivated learning called curious agents. Our reporter Pear spoke to Dr. Saunders about his career, his work, and the future of creativity.
So we're going to talk a bit about artificial intelligence and how that then ends up in robotics and how people can cooperate with robotics. But let's start at how you got started in artificial intelligence and take it from there.
Okay. So when I was looking for an undergraduate degree, I suppose, I was interested in computers. I was interested in being creative with computers. Always been interested in art and design. And I knew I wanted to do something in computer science, but I wasn't sure what. I came down to a short list of either doing cybernetics at Reading University or doing artificial intelligence at Edinburgh University in the UK. I chose to do artificial intelligence, and I've always been very happy with that choice. So I was combining then a lot of work in computer graphics and artificial intelligence. This was the area I was most interested in as an undergraduate, was looking at how can I use techniques from artificial intelligence, neural networks, genetic algorithms, and other search techniques to explore the potential for generating 3D forms, 2D and 3D, 2D images and 3D models. Where I ended up with that was very much influenced by the work of Carl Sims, who was using genetic programming to evolve 2D images, and the work of William Latham, who was using genetic algorithms to evolve 3D sculptures. William Latham is an artist. Carl Sims mostly works in special effects, but is most famous perhaps for his work at Connection Machines as their artist in residence, and worked a lot with those supercomputers there and exploring the potential for that, physics simulations, etc. So I tried combining the work of both of those. So Carl Sims was using genetic programming. I used genetic programming to evolve three-dimensional forms and interactive evolution to allow users to explore the space of possibilities. That was always very interesting to me, because I think possibly the thing I've always wanted to do, and the thing I do now really, is give creative people the tools to explore a space of possibilities. So I always find it most satisfying when I create a piece of software and then hand that over to people who think completely differently from me, who then produce things that I could never imagine with that software. That always is a very exciting possibility for me. And so that's what I was doing with in my undergraduate research. And then when I was looking to do my PhD, I was interested in trying to extend this into design. So to go from generating sculptures, three-dimensional forms, to generating evolving forms for design. And that's how I started at Sydney University doing my PhD. But actually then I quickly got interested in what was motivating people when they were exploring these evolved space, when they were exploring with an interactive evolutionary tool, what was motivating them to actually select what they were selecting? How were they exploring that space? And that got me into psychology of creativity. And actually that's been my focus in my research since then. I've in a field of computational creativity, trying to model creative processes such that when we look at a piece of software, we can attribute that with some creativity, whatever that means. I mean, creativity is still one of those terms, like life and intelligence, all those interesting questions. Creativity is one of those terms which we still don't have a very good definition of. But the simplest or the most agreed definition is the ability to produce things that are both novel and appropriate. Where appropriate may mean aesthetically beautiful or valuable or achieves a purpose for a design. And when I started in that field, it quickly became apparent to me that a lot of the research in computational creativity and in artificial intelligence applied to design focused almost entirely on this question of how to produce things that are appropriate or valuable or aesthetic. That continues to be the focus. After all, it's very hard to appreciate anything if it's not valuable. But for me, the big question that wasn't being asked is, we're leaving novelty, we're leaving the production of something new purely to chance. And that doesn't seem to fit very well with how humans design or are creative. And in fact, when you go into the psychology there, you find that people have a very specific preference, which is that they prefer things that are both similar but different to those that they've experienced before. There are good evolutionary explanations for this. Things that are similar but different to those that we've experienced before give us the maximum opportunity for learning about them very quickly. And so therefore we can learn about environment. So it goes into sort of developmental psychology, and there's been some great work by people like Jürgen Schmidhuber and others who have looked at computational modeling of curiosity. My interest is specifically the computational modeling of curiosity within creativity, within creative pursuits. So whether it be art, design, music, whatever that might be, and how curiosity both drives the creative exploration and how it feeds back into social interaction between individuals and the development of cultures. So all of these things coming together. So when we in software, a lot of the work that I've done is producing agents that are curious, that they model some of these aspects of having a preference for things which are similar but different to those that have been categorized in within the system before, so that they've learned a model of these things. And then often the hardest bit is figuring out the dimensions along which to judge similarity. And that's often where I still have my fingers in the pie the most, I suppose, where I'm still having the most amount of influence is determining what the perceptual capabilities are of one of these agents and how they determine similarity. But after that, it's a matter of then modeling curiosity, and typically that often means modeling something close to boredom. So that is, we can have agents which are capable of determining that recent experiences are very similar to those that they've had before, or they are so different from those that they've had before that they cannot categorize these new experiences. And so in those two cases, there is a search for some middle ground where they can learn at an appropriate rate. And really, it starts turning this whole idea of creativity being about being both novel and appropriate. It says that there are certain types of novelty that are more appropriate than other types of novelty, so that we can experience them and understand them and learn about them quickly. And that gets into a whole social aspect of when we have a group of agents, those agents can share what they produce. So let's say they use an evolutionary algorithm to produce images. They can share those images with other agents, and they can make judgments about how interesting those images are based on their own models of what they've experienced before, other images that they've experienced before, and also how novel or what their preference is for novelty. So agents can have different preferences for the amount of novelty that they will tolerate or that they're interested in, depending on perhaps on how fast they can learn or other aspects that may have influenced their preference for novelty. We get into a social aspect there where we can start looking at what are the social structures that evolve then. So we may have, if we actually create a simulation where we have agents with ranges of preferences for novelty, and we allow them to communicate generated artifacts, they will naturally form into what we call cliques. They will naturally form into groups where they like the work of other agents, or they like the artifacts of other agents, but they don't like the artifacts of another group of agents because they've gone off into a different part of the what we might call the design space, the space of possible designs. So they become increasingly differentiated, and we end up with these social groups that have very closed sort of communication networks. But that can be very interesting as well. And if the groups then become close enough that it's possible for agents to exchange between the groups, we end up with major shifts or possibly major injections of new ideas into a group. And that's an interesting sort of social model. That comes straight out. We also can model things like having agents that innovate too quickly, so have a very high preference for novelty compared to the other groups, or have a very low preference for novelty compared to other groups, and how those are integrated into the social group. So, for instance, if we model an agent with a very low preference for novelty, it won't innovate very quickly. It will innovate very slowly, and in fact will be ignored by the rest of the agents. If we have an agent that innovates very quickly, on the other hand, it will also get ignored by the other agents because the work that it's producing is so different from everything else that they simply cannot integrate them into their model. So the novelty is not interesting, even though it may be very novel. And this sort of builds on the work of Colin Martindale, who proposed a thought experiment called the law of novelty, that you have to innovate. You have to innovate in order to be recognized within a society that values creativity. But he really only looked at the case where you didn't innovate quickly enough. The model extends, what we showed in simulation is the model extends to cases where you innovate too quickly. And I think that's another interesting aspect of being able to produce these sorts of simulations. And then more recently, I've been looking at how language can be integrated into these models. And language becomes a very interesting aspect of that, because then you've not only got the artifact, the image, the design, whatever, but also an utterance that describes that work. And that becomes a reference. I mean, you have a way of referencing, ideally referencing not just the work, but also properties of the work. So if you have a world in which the agents have only ever produced blue squares and red triangles, if you've got a language that's evolved to describe blue and red and square and triangle, it becomes then possible for the agents to imagine a world which has blue triangles. And while that is something that they've never, at the same time, that's something they've never seen. And it becomes a way for agents such as these sort of curious agents to produce interesting linguistic structures. So to search purely in the language for something that is an interesting description, because it is a description that is similar but different to those that they've seen before. And then to have that, set that as a goal for a search, for a search. And this in itself is obviously a very simple, but this is a much like the way a lot of people think about design. People think about design as imagining a world that is different, or imagining things, how things could be different in the world, and then searching for ways to satisfy that imagined future. And so if we can do this with the evolution of a grounded language, which is building on the work of Luke Steels and Simon Kirby, then we can get into this modeling of not just a curiosity that's driven by not finding things interesting at the moment, but driven by the imagination of something that could be, how things could be different, which is what a lot of us think about when we think about something being curious. We think about the curiosity of searching out potentials. I mean, maybe we think of cat-like curiosity, where we want to get into everything. Well, that maybe is more like the diversive curiosity. There's nothing interesting in where I am. I'm going to search out everywhere else and see what's around. But when we think about humans being curious, we really think about this other type, this specific curiosity, where we imagine a possibility, and then that possibility being something that we can search for. And so that's really what I'm working on with the software simulation side, is trying to build a minimal but in some ways well-rounded model of creative systems, that is, creativity at the individual, the social, and the cultural level. So trying to have all those things come together. And that's really where I've been working. And these are autonomous systems that work independently from humans. And so what they produce is of very little value to us, but it's of great value to the agents that are sharing them. They determine what is valuable, what is novel. And that's just interesting to then see from a modeling perspective. More recently, I've been getting into actually looking at embodied models of curiosity and specifically trying to build curious robots, I suppose, is the easiest way of thinking about it. Although we started a project called Curious Places, which is about trying to embody intelligence into an actual space. But in a lot of cases, we're building independent units, independent robotic units that are then within that space. So we've developed quite a few different projects there. We developed rooms that would monitor the activity within the room. So we developed a curious research place, which would was designed around our own seminar room here. Each of the PowerPoint presentations that were given in the room were uploaded to the server. The server would then go and search for other material related to the presentations that maybe happened over a week or over a month, and then produce a slideshow of other material that it found relative to that, that it determined was interesting based upon the material that was already presented. Now, the slideshows weren't presentations in their own, but they became a way for the room to augment what was happening in that, to augment the activities in that room. So that was an example of actually trying to change the room itself such that it became an active participant of the activities and responded to the activities within the room. We've been working, and that's sort of seeing the room, the whole room, as a sort of intelligent system, where the actuators were its projection systems and the inputs were, again, the computer where the slides were uploaded, and the whole planning system was really just going out on the internet and then bringing information back. But we've also been playing with autonomous robotic systems. The Curious Whispers project was the most recent that an honours student of mine, Emma Chi, developed some very nice robots that could play simple tunes, just very simple 8-note tunes, and they can listen to the tunes from each other. And the real purpose of this, of the first experiment with that, was to look at how humans and robots interact within an environment. So the space, the as a curious place, it's a place you walk into where there are obviously curious or creative or interesting robots within that space, and how people interact with that. So we have these simple robots which can play tunes and listen to tunes and compose new tunes based on what they've heard. And we also provide in the space a very simple synthesizer to allow people to enter into a conversation with these robots by playing tunes. So they become in some ways part of the, for a limited time, the robot's society. And that's one of those things where we're very interested in how people understand the space that they've walked into, how they start interacting with the robots, how they understand what the robots are capable of doing without any real prompting from us. It's a very playful environment. It's one where people can come in and they see three robots that are already interacting with each other, and that you've got a synthesizer that's obviously can play notes. And if you play notes, then the robots stop and listen, and then maybe will close down to rehearse playing a new song, and then open up and play variations upon the songs that you've played. Interestingly, some people came into the room and thought that the power relationship was the other way around from the way they would normally imagine. So rather than, so they would come in and think that they had to repeat the songs that the robots were playing rather than introducing their own songs. So it turned out that it was best to introduce people to the robots in isolation. So one robot on its own that someone could interact with. And then you could put them into the group situation where they, so it's sort of, it was a more balanced power relationship between the person and the robot initially, and then they could get into the social situation where they feel like they can become part of this ongoing conversation between the robots. So it's obvious that there is an interaction between the robots that's autonomous of you, but it's also possible then to enter into that. And it's a bit like the problem of entering into a conversation when you're in a cocktail party or something like that. You walk into a party and you've got to try and understand what's going on, what the conversation is between people, and then you can join in, but you've got to understand the context first. And I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about how we interact with robots and with technology. This
that whole, it is a conversation more than the robots than telling us stuff or we telling the robot stuff.
That's right, because obviously we have, and it's about how do you start that conversation, because I think that's really the knack here, is because we're not building humans, and so therefore we are building things that have a different perspective on the world, and we can develop social conventions, which is really what a lot of user interfaces are, a social convention of a master slave. But there are other ways of communicating. There's a whole range of ways of communicating, and particularly influenced by the work of the cybernetician Gordon Pask, who developed a conversation theory, which has been applied in education and all sorts of different areas. And I've been very influenced by this whole idea of having a conversation with technology, and how we can then develop systems that facilitate that conversation happening. If you don't try and build humanoid robots, if you don't, I've got nothing wrong with building robots in the form of a human, but if you don't try and suggest that they have human capabilities, and rather you open up the possibilities for exploring what the capabilities of the robot are, and finding a middle ground where you can work together, that is where things get really sort of exciting. But it's also very natural for us. We're used to being surrounded by intelligences other than human, and understanding what they can do. We're masters of that in many cases. You know, we have great relationships with many animals, and that's really what where we can look. So they're very different sorts of relationships, but the more sophisticated we can make those conversational abilities, I think the more successful we can be at actually producing technology that we can get to grips with fairly quickly. And in this respect, I think that the work that Luke Steels and others have done in robots learning languages through the playing of language games, I mean, it's still a long way away from being a practical way of having a casual, entering into a casual conversation with a robot. But the ability for a robot to then learn some sort of shorthand for what an instruction might mean through a negotiated conversation is going to be one of those things that I think we're going to get more and more used to. It'd probably be a very gradual, natural change. But that's the sorts of way that I can see us having a very successful relationship with technology. Less about trying to hide the interface, but more about trying to make that interface actually obvious and negotiable. Some people talk about a seamful interface, an interface that is clear. You know where the interface is, and you know, and you can see it. It's not something that you're trying to magically get rid of. It's not something that's hidden, but rather that's something that's obvious but familiar. And those sorts of interfaces are the ones where I think we can have a lot of success with bringing technology in. And I think there are some great examples of those sorts of things coming through, especially in sort of the world of toys, There are some wonderful examples of just things that have natural interfaces. This, the whole tangible computing area has a lot of wonderful stuff happening there. And it's probably something that we're going to see just as the previous generation grew up with computers. I think the current generation is growing up with intelligent hardware and growing up with robots. And that will probably make a huge difference in how we see robotics evolve in the next 20 to 30 years.
And how they communicate, have this conversation with robots like a computer professional have with the computer. They know that the computer has certain limitations and abilities and limitations, and then adapts to that and gets the most out of this relationship we have with technology. I think that this is a very, very interesting aspect of this research, that we have a conversation, a relationship to get the most of what we want out of this.
Exactly.
Work.
Yeah, I think that's precisely the point, is that by having a generation grow up with the idea that they can build programmable hardware, I think we're going to see an enormous increase in people understanding what that programmable hardware is capable of. And naturally, that's sort of gets us into the robotics area. Although it's going to just, I think, appear as it's going to be less about, again, I think it's going to be less about the robot and much more about what we might call ubiquitous computing or some other aspect of tangible computing, where it's just natural to have hardware and software and work with them together, and that the next generation will just naturally work with that in the same way that the current generation takes to the iPad without any fuss at all. I mean, it's such a natural interface. I mean, of course, they've got rid of some of the more confusing aspects, such as the file system. That's helpful if you're going to make technology, and it's probably going to technology that you can negotiate with. But it's probably going to evolve like that. We're going to have some sort of clumsy first attempts and continue on until we can find a model where it's easy for us to pick up this sort of robotic technology and use it to whatever purpose we want to. And of course, things like 3D printing and CNC machines that people are installing at their home so they can build their own hardware is again becoming one of those skills that, in the same way that when I grew up, it was just natural to have a personal computer at home, and you just learn how to program in your spare time as a hobby. You make your own games or whatever. Now it seems that it's very natural for someone to have a 3D printer in their bedroom and then just to learn 3D modeling and be able to build whatever it is that they need as they need it. And increasingly that's coming with the ability to add a microprocessor, or even with the latest one, a full Linux system, etc., into the hardware, and we're well into the realm of building robots and all sorts of other interesting devices as we need them. So,
And that will also develop that generation's conversation skill with the same hardware.
Of course, I mean, yeah. I think there's a competence there, but possibly in terms of the conversation, the most important thing is understanding the context, understanding the capabilities of the other. The robotic other. I mean, understanding what their capabilities are, and understanding how to negotiate. Now, that might be in the same way a negotiator negotiates with a computer, which is very much I write the software and it runs on the computer. But it could be in this sense of actually very naturally having an open system where there are standard ways, and this is, of course, what I'm trying to develop here. There are standard ways of building software such that it is open, adaptable, and capable of entering into a negotiated set of meanings, which can be the base of a conversation. If we can develop that sort of software base, which of course is some of the work that's being done in many of the work on evolution of language, if we can develop those sorts of systems as something that anyone can just pick up and add into their piece of hardware, then we develop these sort of open conversations And I think that's a very exciting possibility that we could see that happening.
Certainly, this is very interesting, and we're definitely going to try to keep up with this work. So thank you very much for being part of the podcast, and I'll hope to be back soon.
Thanks very much.
And that's the end of 2013's first episode. As always, you can find additional information and any past episode on our website at robotspodcast.com. We will be back on the 25th of January. Goodbye. Curiosity with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.